In 1972, the United States Air Force established the Aggressors, a unit of highly skilled pilots who studied Soviet aircraft, pilots, and tactics. The Aggressors taught the Air Force and the Joint Services what they had learned and knew about the Soviet air forces. They flew aircraft designed to replicate adversary fighters, including their tactics, and for a while even flew actual MiGs as part of the Constant Peg program. The role and mission they did and continue to execute is to stress friendly forces by knowing the threat, teaching the threat, and replicating the threat. My guest in this episode is Lieutenant Colonel retired Jan Kutstall, an F-15 and F-16 pilot who flew at Nellis for over 10 years, and for much of that time as an Eagle and Viper aggressor. We talk about the nearly 50 years of history and the contribution to the United States and coalition air forces of the aggressors. This is the Air Minded Podcast, Nellis Season. Welcome back, listeners. This is the Air-Minded Guerrilla Tyson Wetzel back with another episode from the Nellis season. My guest in this episode is Lieutenant Colonel Jan Kutstall, who recently retired from the Air Force Reserve after more than two decades of flying fighters for the service. Kutz was an instructor pilot in the European NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training Program, and he completed an operational tour as an F-15 pilot before becoming an Eagle aggressor in the 65th Aggressor Squadron at Nellis Air Force Base from 2009 to 2013. He transitioned to the F-16 and was Director of Operations for the Air Force Reserve's 706th Fighter Squadron, also at Nellis. And there he flew as a Viper aggressor and in Detachment 3 of the 53rd Test and Evaluation Group. In 2018, Kutz became the commander of the 706th Fighter Squadron, the largest fighter squadron in the Air Force's total force. Kutz knows the history of the aggressors like few others. He has a wealth of experience. He told me he flew in 40 red flags, which is an incredible number. And though I couldn't pin him down on the question I really wanted him to answer, which is which fighter he loved more, the Eagle or the Viper, he answered everything else I threw at him. A few notes about the episode. I've known Kutz for 15 years, which means he calls me by my first call sign, Getter, and it also means that we slipped into a pretty fast-paced, occasionally jargony discussion as opposed to a true interview. But if you've stuck around this long, you know I'm not really a great interview. I just like to talk anyways. As we were going through, we defined most of the acronyms. There's a few I caught in the re-listen, and I'll go over those now. One was NIPR, which is Non-Classified Internet Protocol Network. It's the unclassified network that the U.S. military uses. FME, that's Foreign Material Exploitation. That's when we, just like the name implies, take foreign equipment and we exploit it. SME or SME, Subject Matter Expert, and then GO, which is General Officer. Finally, I drop an F-bomb. Sorry, it's from one of my favorite aggressor stories or anecdotes, and I warn you before I say the phrase, so if you feel you need to, just forward 15 seconds as soon as I give you the warning. We also covered four books pretty quickly, so I wanted to restate them here. They are Sierra Hotel by C.R. Andrig, Red Eagles by Steve Davies, The Air Force Way of War by Brian Lasley, and America's Secret MiG Squadron by Evil Peck. With that said, let's hear from Kutz about the U.S. Air Force aggressors. All right, my guest today is Lieutenant Colonel retired Jan Kutstall, a former aggressor pilot. I could lie to all of you and tell you this is the first time we're doing this interview, but I forgot to hit record, so we're doing the first 15 minutes of this interview a second time. But I want to be honest with all of you air-minded listeners. Anyways, I'm really excited about the guest today to talk about one of the big missions that is done at Nellis, and that is the aggressors. We'll talk a lot about the flying aggressors, but also a little bit about kind of all the missions that the aggressors do, why we have that unit, and hearing from a guy who flew a long time out at Nellis and a long time in the aggressors. So Kutz, we've known each other for a long time. We were company grade officers together over a decade ago at Eglin Air Force Base. It is awesome to have you on the podcast finally. Welcome and happy Sunday. How are you?
Happy Sunday. It's great to be here. I've been an avid listener almost since the very beginning, and it's great to finally be on. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I'm excited. The Aggressors are a great mission. Been around since 1972. There's a lot to talk about here, and we'll try to get through all of it. My last guest was at work early on an afternoon when I interviewed him, so I wasn't able to ask him what he was drinking. I will tell you that I've got what I think is Virginia's finest from Devil's Backbone Vienna Lager. That's what I'm going with. What do you have today?
Well, as luck would have it, we ended up having to record this in the early afternoon, so probably a little early for brown liquor. I am, however, having this delectable Keller beer from the Radeberger Brewery in Dresden, which, here's your trivia of the day, is just so happens to be Vladimir Putin's favorite beer from when he was the KGB bureau chief in Dresden way back in the day when he was still in that line of work. So delicious.
So anyways, moving on from what you got today, one of my favorite questions to ask, because I always learn a little bit about the guests, even guys that I've known for a very long time, is what is your Air Force origin story? How did you end up flying fighters in the United States Air Force?
The answer to that question is kind of similar to so many of the others you had on the podcast so far, which is it's almost always a lucky lining up of events, the lining up of stars that kind of got you where you needed to be, right? I grew up without any aspirations of joining the military whatsoever. My dad was in the State Department. So I grew up a little bit like a military brat, but not close to any bases, always in funky countries in the remote corners of the world. When I went to college, I was lucky enough to sort of out of the blue get offered an Air Force scholarship. And at that point, I just kind of considered taking a look at it and just kind of seeing how it would work out. Definitely not something I had planned ahead of time, but again, I'm happy that it happened because that lucky turn of events ended up translating into a 21 and a half year career that that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, of course. And so let's start on, let's dig into a little bit more detail. So that's how you get in the Air Force. How do you end up flying fighters and then eventually become an aggressor pilot?
So I was lucky enough to get selected, not just for pilot training, but to attend Euronato Joint Jet Pilot Training, NJET, out at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas, which was right up my alley because it's not just training that is strictly U.S., but it's done jointly with all our NATO partners there. So over a half of the instructor cadre and of the student body as well was all from those partner countries. And it was a fantastic time. Got to fly with some great people. At least back in the day when I attended, that was a program that kind of set you up with a fighter follow-on if you wanted it. The trouble that I happen to run into is that by the time I graduated, I just didn't know what I wanted to fly. Again, I'm so new to the military. I'm still getting to know the different communities and kind of figuring out what I like and what I dislike. And I just didn't know. So even though
What did you fly out there? T-38s?
So yeah, T-38s, obviously starting a T-37 back in the day, kind of dating myself there. But yeah, bottom line is I graduated high enough that I could have almost had the pick of any airframe that was available. But I chose to actually just stay as a T-38 instructor for 3 years, get my feet under me. I just got married at the time and figure out what follow-on mission I really wanted. And again, in a lucky turn of events, I happened to run or fly together with a former German MiG-29 driver that kind of took me under his wing for the 3 years I was out there as an instructor and kind of, you know, told me about his experiences. And I think one of the key pieces of intel he gave me was you really want to fly the C model because every time we flew against the C model in the fulcrum, that is the one community that just consistently, you know, waxed the floor with us. So that was definitely something that stuck with me. I kind of warmed up to the air-to-air mission, and I'm so happy that I did because it is, I can't imagine having done anything more interesting, more engaging, more mentally challenging. It was fantastic. So if Lumpy is listening to this podcast, thank you, brother. You're in my Christmas list for life. I appreciate the advice.
Well, that's awesome. And you know, as I listen to you talk about that, I start to think about how some of the things that will serve you as an aggressor pilot, some of those seeds are planted while you're there as a young first assignment instructor pilot, doing a lot of instructing, which is a big part of being an aggressor that we'll get into. And then hearing from a MiG-29 pilot, I'm sure getting lots of great stories about that airframe and then how that airframe interacts with some of our aircraft, in particular, you talk about the F-15C, but I'm sure the Viper and others. And you can kind of see, you know, looking back, it all looks like a straight line to make you an aggressor pilot, but obviously that's not what happened. So from there, that's where our paths cross. You decide to become an Eagle driver and come out to Eglin. Is that correct?
Exactly. Again, the finest fighter squadron in the Air Force, as I'm sure you'll agree with me. I think we have a plethora of contemporaries that on to do great things in the Air Force and are still doing great things for the Air Force and the DoD writ large. And a great 3 years at the Eglin Air Patch.
Yeah. We were actually just talking about our squadron commander, one of our mentors, retired now, Brigadier General Knocker Eisler, just an awesome leader that helped, whether you as a pilot or me as an intelligence officer, just kind of bred in excellence, working hard, still having fun. Great time being Knocker squadron. And I think the fact that there's been so many mighty guerrillas that have been successful out of that squadron, I think says a lot about him and the culture that was set there. From that point, you'd done your first operational assignment in the Eagle, moved out to Nellis. How did you become an aggressor pilot out at Nellis?
Yeah, so again, it was the alignment of the stars at the time. With me having been an instructor pilot as my first assignment, I was a little older than probably the average guy going through the guerrillas as their first assignment. As a result, the following assignments that were available to me were probably somewhat restricted. But as luck would have it, that new squadron of 65th aggressors had just opened at Nellis flying the F-15C. It was, again, on its way up. They were taking in new aircraft, taking in new people, getting new gear from the foreign material exploitation community, which I'm sure is something we're going to touch on later. But it was a great time to get there. And it was an assignment that just so happened to become available at the time that I was having to move. So I touched down at Nellis, I joined the 65th, and I was hooked on the mission almost from the get-go. It was almost like, walking into SpaceX 5 years ago, kind of that startup mentality where they're doing things that have never been done before. I loved it. It was a great time.
So you hit on a bunch that I want to talk about there. So I've noticed in the aggressor history, there's been some times where it's kind of waxed and waned. It's gotten big and then contracted again in the early 70s, early mid, late 70s, really expanded. As I've touched on a lot in this podcast, a lot of pissed off Vietnam veterans coming back saying we were not trained. And one of the major things that came out of that belief that they were not trained for combat was the aggressors. And we'll get into that. But in the 70s, you see the 64th and the 65th, the 18th, I think, was out in Clark in the Pacific. There was a squadron out in Germany, started to contract about the time, kind of late aughts and into the early 10s, we started to see it expand again. The 64th was the Vipers out at Nellis, but we got the 65th standing up with the Eagles. And then I believe the 18th re-stood up again at Eielson. So you were kind of there at an era where it was starting to really expand. Unfortunately, for some belt tightening in the sequestration days of 2013, eventually that squadron, the 65th went away. So kind of what happens to you at that point? I guess you'd probably been flying in the 65th for how many years at that point?
I must have been just about a full assignment. So I was kind of getting to that 3.5-ish or so a year point. But again, it's that whole, random alignment of stars theme kind of continued to carry on. So, one door closed, three other ones opened, and you never know what's going to happen. So a few things that happened right around that time was I received an offer to stay at Nellis and continue my journey there as a reservist. Which was, again, fantastic for me and for my family at the time to be able to make that jump. And then also being offered the opportunity to fly the Eagle for a little while longer, but then transition over to the Viper because of some other career opportunities that were opening themselves up tied to that qualification. So it was awesome to make that transition, to stay at Nellis, to get another MDS under my belt, and to do some cool things that came around as a result of that.
MDS, Mission Design Series, another combat platform, if you will. Okay, we're going to get into the aggressors. That's what I brought you here to talk about. But you talked about a couple of things that I have to address first and foremost. The great age-old debate, or at least since the late 70s, the Eagle versus the Viper. You've flown both. You're going to be in a unique place to talk about it. What do you love about each platform? I'm guessing as your first love, the Eagle, you're going to come out and say that you love the Eagle. But what was it like flying both of those fighters?
First off, I mean, I'm lucky to have been offered that opportunity. Flying both jets was amazing. One of the things I got to do in conjunction with being an aggressor and then flying with tests after that as well was to touch on a lot of other platforms as well. So I flew the F-18 with the Australians. I flew the Typhoon with the Brits. I flew the Su-30 with the Indians. I mean, you name it. So I did get a chance to jump into a lot of jets that, again, I think maybe the average fighter pilot wouldn't have gotten a chance to get into. But I'm gonna plead the fifth on this one here and say that each jet is
they're got like its your own, children.
It's good. Each jet got its own has its own virtues and vices. I mean, I enjoyed just the raw power of flying the Eagle. I mean, it's what that jet can do just in terms of thrust to weight ratio and the amount of, you know, transmitted energy coming out of the front end of that radar is just absolutely unbelievable. The fastest I've ever been was on my penultimate flight in the Eagle, where I hit 2.12 Mach, which I still can't believe I've gone that fast. That jet was probably about to come apart. But then you jump into a jet like the F-16, which has got ergonomics that are so well designed. The avionics are so well integrated and so intuitive to operate, you know, and just that feeling of, you know, you not being strapped into the jet, but the jet being strapped onto you and kind of being an extension. And it's just insane. So like I said, there's things about both jets that I like. I'm grateful to have been able to fly both and to have been able to, again, touch all these other platforms as well that I got to fly along.
All right. So you're not going to decide between the two. So let me give you a scenario here. You're flying 1v1 protecting your homeland against an Indian Su-30, the Su-30 MKI. Would you rather be in the Eagle or would you rather be in the Viper?
I'll say it this way so your savvy listeners can draw their own conclusions. I'll take the 104-0, please.
Ah, there we go. All right. There we go. I think we know what one that is. Okay. Now we'll talk about the aggressors on the next question, I promise. But you mentioned Nellis. You've spent, I think you were saying, 12 years at Nellis or right around that. Every guest that I brought on in this season to talk about Nellis, I've started with the what makes Nellis special. And I've heard a lot of really good ones, the people, the integration, the realism, all of which you get in spades in the aggressors. What do you think makes Nellis Air Force Base special?
I think the key elements that makes Nellis different from every other place is the fact that it's kind of the center of excellence where all elements, not just within the DOD, but, you know, within the intelligence community, within the engineering community, within industry, it is the place where we all come together to get better. And as a result, you know, I don't think there's any other place where you just have that amount of expertise just concentrated into one place. If you want to know something about a particular system, about a particular tactic, about a particular threat capability, about something that industry is working on, you can literally do that in-house at Nellis. And if you don't have the expertise resident right there in Las Vegas when you need it, you can count on whoever has the answer to the question you have coming into town, you know, a couple of weeks from now, at which point you're going to get to put your heads together with him and discuss what it is you need to solve. I know that's something that General Drolley touched on his interview with you as well, which is just that the level of integration and just the concentration of expertise. I don't think you can replicate that any other place.
All right, let's get into the aggressors. I was just doing the math. We'll be 50 years old next year, officially started as an organization in 1972. The aggressors love their history, whether it is a former Soviet-built aircraft out front or the heritage room that we don't call a bar. Everything about being in the aggressor building is awesome and makes you understand the heritage. Why don't you take us back a little bit? Why were the aggressors established? What do they do for the United States Air Force and truly the joint force, and in many cases, the combined force? What do the aggressors bring to the fight?
So I think at a very basic level, if you dive back into history, you have to consider the chain of events that kind of brought the aggressors into existence in the first place, right? So you actually have to go all the way back to the Department of Defense, taking a look at the aftermath of World War II, going into Korea and onto Vietnam, and kind of taking stock of how the warfighting skills, in particular in the air-to-air arena, kind of ebbed and flowed, right? The takeaway from World War II is that despite the fact that we were fighting that conflict with very basic equipment, if you kind of consider the big picture, and that we're fighting that conflict with a relatively unskilled force, at least as far as the air arena is concerned, the fact that we walked away from that conflict with an 8-to-1 kill ratio in the air is absolutely unbelievable, right? Again, taking all these factors into account. You then kind of proceeded onto the Korean conflict, where you had a lot of people with World War II expertise operating better equipment. As a result, again, we walked away from that conflict with a close to 10-to-1 kill ratio. So again, improving further on kind of what we had in World War II before. But then you fast forwarded a couple of years to Vietnam, and our kill ratio actually shrunk from that 10-to-1 high all the way down to about 2.5-to-1. As a matter of fact, if you kind of take just the linebacker 1 and 2 operations into account kind of at the peak of air activity in Vietnam, it actually receded to just over 1-to-1. So a really kind of terrible showing, if you will, by the combined force.
And certainly that's not something that we don't look for. A fair fight, we look for an overwhelming advantage in the air, especially to establish air superiority, not just for the sake of controlling the air, but what that allows you to do. Ground maneuver, I like to point out that April 15th, 1953 is the last date that a U.S. Member on the ground, either soldier or marine, was killed from the air by the adversary. That's an unbelievable statistic, nearly 70 years, and that is because we have control of the air. So it's not just a cool mission, it is a mission that enables everything else. So sorry, didn't mean to cut in, but I think I'm nearly as passionate about air superiority as you probably are.
No, that's exactly right. And one has to appreciate the fact that the Department of Defense had the wherewithal to see this ebbing and flowing of skill in the air-to-air arena and actually try to do something about it, right? So there were a multitude of studies that were conducted kind of in the, while the Vietnam War was still going on, and in the aftermath, kind of in the early to mid 70s there, taking a look at what was going on, and again, what we could do to kind of counter that unfortunate trend, right? So again, the ALT report was put out in 1968. Again, if guys want to dive into that, probably a little beyond the context of what we can discuss here.
But
again,
I will tell you, we're going to be talking about Top Gun once I'm done with the Nellis season. I already got a couple guest books. So the ALT report will lead to Navy Top Gun, just one of those reports that was being done by the Joint Force. Sorry.
That's exactly right, and great segue there, Getter. So the ALT report comes out in 1968, right? So while we still have air activity going on in Vietnam, Navy spins up Top Gun in 1969, and that was actually one of the things that precipitated the Red Baron report, which was published in, I believe, 1972, 1973, after the conflict, which is, They took a look at the performance of Navy tactical air specifically in that kind of linebacker to slightly after linebacker timeframe, and found out, hey, why do they have a 6-to-1 kill ratio, but the Air Force has a 1.1 kill ratio at almost the exact same time? And sure enough, they came to the conclusion that the Navy was using more fluid formations, more adaptable tactics, and that the North Vietnamese were noticing that, and they were avoiding engaging Navy TAC air to begin with, and they were tangling with, you know, Air Force tactical air instead, because they were getting better results out of it. That's pretty much the simplest way to put it. The Red Baron report was the next study that was conducted kind of into that, which was looking at, again, the bigger picture of how tactical air forces were trained in the Air Force specifically, and how that was driving specific outcomes during the Vietnam conflict. If any of your listeners, have Nipper access and can get their historians to dig out that particular report for them, it is very girthy. It is tens of thousands of pages. Most of it has been unclassified, but I believe it's still restricted to government domains only. If anybody wants to read this, I went through this in minute detail and I found it absolutely fascinating, because that report literally broke down every single merge that an Air Force, either individual fighter or formation, had against a threat force, what the parameters were, how it came about from, you know, beyond visual range to within visual range, and then what the actual outcome of that merge was, and what lessons learned, if any, kind of were drawn away from that. It goes
into unbelievable report. I mean, they interviewed most of the air crew, right? And then they also looked at both onboard and offboard sources of data to really give the most realistic reconstruction, so that you can build the lessons learned.
That is exactly right. And again, the fact that they had the bandwidth and that they invested the energy and the dollars required to take that detailed of a look at the problem, I find that incredible. And again, what
I do think, though, when you brought up the Ault report, the Navy in the conflict is analyzing, and they stand up an adversary squadron, and they stand up Top Gun, their version of the Air Force Weapons School, which predates, and the Air Force did theirs later, and to their credit, did an outstanding job. But I think that's why, that's a big reason why, when you get to the linebackers, the Navy is having much better performance. As you talk about, they have modified their tactics to learn lessons, not just identify them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, anytime we kind of bring the dreaded D word into the equation, right? So talk about how we have this doctrinal divergence between, you know, different services, and how they were in fact more nimble in adapting not just their, you know, baseline tactics, but their overall doctrine of how they were going to crack the air nut in that kind of conflict. I think it's laudable. The fact that they, again, managed to achieve better results quicker at, you know, a fairly modest investment. I think it's fantastic. And the fact that the Air Force then jumped on that same bandwagon, and it led to some of these awesome initiatives that you mentioned, which obviously include the aggressors. I think that was the right way to solve the problem. I just wish we could have done it, you know, 6 to 9 years earlier.
Yeah. My buddy McFly, who always says that I don't have enough Navy in here, is going to be very happy. Yeah. Is going to be very happy that we're talking Ault Report, Top Gun, and giving just a little bit of credit to the Navy, but enough of that. It is time to move on, from the Navy. So you talk about the Red Baron reports lead to the aggressors. So what did they do, especially early on? What is the charter of the aggressors in 72 as they are stood up? How are they built to address some of the problems that were identified in Red Baron and other reports?
Great question. So the obviously, you know, the Red Baron report being as girthy as it is, so to speak, you have to kind of condense the takeaways a little bit into some big picture broad strokes there, if you will. One of the key takeaways from Red Baron was the fact that we, the Air Force, were getting too comfortable just training within our own community against similar assets, against similar tactics, so that in those situations where we were exposed to threat systems and threat tactics for the same time, we were doing what we instinctively did in training back home, and that just wasn't working out, right? So number one recommendation, if you will, out of that Red Baron report was we need to train dissimilar more often. We need to train like we fight, and it's the only way that we're going to get better, right? Another takeaway from the Red Baron report was that the learning curve seemed to be fairly steep, right? If a air crew member could get through his first 10 combat missions alive, it was significantly more likely that he was going to survive however many missions he had remaining in the conflict, strictly because that learning curve that took place within those first 10 missions was so critical. So the Red Baron report then asked the question, what if we could somehow simulate those first 10 missions back here at home against that dissimilar adversary that they are also recommending, so that, no kidding, when, you know, an air crew member steps into a conflict scenario for the first time, he doesn't have that bug fever, he doesn't have that lack of dissimilar experience, and he just approaches it from a standpoint of confidence, leading to that, no kidding, overwhelming advantage that you touched on earlier there, Gutter, that we are looking to achieve. So, again, the segue there being, you know, there were multiple initiatives within the Air Force, one of them being the weapons school, as you already touched on, the second one being Red Flag, that targeted that simulation of those first 10 missions in a kind of a training scenario. And then the last one being the aggressors, with the stated goal to provide that dissimilar combat experience to as broad a spectrum of units in the Air Force as we possibly could, so we could get them ready.
All right. A lot going on there. I've mentioned on a couple of podcasts, what you're talking about is my favorite era of Air Force history. And you really get this confluence or convergence of events happening at Nellis. in about the 72 to 76, 77 time frame. So Randy O'Neill, a major at the time, is the one that is really pushing the aggressor squadron. Moody Suter stands up red flag. The first one is done in 75. You've got three unbelievable instructors, well, a whole bunch of wonderful instructors at the weapons school, but three of them become four-star generals that we know very well. Dick Myers becomes a chairman of the Joint Chiefs. John Jumper becomes a commander of Air Combat Command, and then eventually chief of staff of the Air Force. And then Ron Keyes becomes another commander of ACC or Air Combat Command, and they're redoing the weapons school. I think the weapons school took a lot of licks from not really changing their tactics in Vietnam. They were very much the welded wing. They did not move to the fluid four. They're indicted for that. They start to change. Red flag is established, and the aggressors really help everything out. So it's a wonderful era that really changes the way that we fight. And I think we get to see, I believe, the benefits of that in Desert Storm and how we develop air supremacy over Iraq. All right. Lot to discuss with being an aggressor pilot. So I think the first myth that I'd like to go busting here is that an aggressor pilot simply flies. So if you could talk to me, I'm not looking for a day in the life of the aggressor pilot, but knowing that you don't just strap into a jet and say, I'm simulating a MiG-29 today, come and get me, and then fly the same way you normally would fly the Viper or the Eagle. Talk to me about what makes a professional aggressor.
For sure. It's a very key distinction that we like to make, right? As a matter of fact, the tagline we drill into each one of our new aggressors' craniums the day that they hit the squadron is never, ever, ever allow IJRA to invade your way of operating. IJRA standing for It's Just Red Air. It's never just red air. You have to be better. You have to be a professional adversary, and you have to locating be that bringing together of threat expertise, of high fidelity simulation, and kind of the keeper of the rules of engagement in a training scenario, so that we can maintain overall safety and we can get the training objectives out of each scenario that we're looking to achieve. So I'm sure that the aggressor mantra kind of got tossed around in previous discussions in your podcast there before, Getter, but every aggressor approaches their mission set with the mantra of know, teach, and replicate, right? So know being the number one kind of core skill that you have to have. You have to know the threat. That goes from top level doctrine about how individual threat countries are going to operate and how they're going to asymmetrically counter us, right? That know piece then flows into the teach part of the mantra, which is you not just have to get that knowledge from any of the sources that you have access to, but you have to be able to credibly and succinctly, you know, bring those across to the combat air forces that's relying on that data to get better. And then the replicate piece, which kind of encompasses all of the flying that we do, is really just the third and potentially least important of those three pieces of the mantra. If you know the threat and you can teach it credibly, then simulating it well when you go out to fly should be almost like a natural progression of everything else you do as an aggressor.
Absolutely. So starting early on, I think it was O'Neill and a couple of the other early aggressors, they almost pried the doors open of the intelligence vaults, if you will. And they built a brief that they called The Man. And it was about the Russian fighter pilot and how a Russian fighter pilot is built and then what they do. And it was designed to teach not just what they do in the air, but what kind of drives them, how they learn their training. And it really helps in the understanding, the being able to teach it back and the being able to replicate. And that model is still used today. The aggressors have a really tight relationship with the intelligence community. So they're getting all the new stuff. So they're replicating it the correct way and teaching it the correct way, which is, I think, a lot of times something that is just overlooked on the aggressors is how important they are to teaching, not just in the air, but also in the ground, and in particular in the debrief room, I would argue.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like with any new organization, right, Getter, I think the initial challenge when we were talking about their inception back in the 70s was just to build enough credibility and just build enough background to actually get a seat at the table, right? Some of those challenges with interfacing with the intelligence community that you talked about earlier were just, you know, people had distrust of anybody outside of their little stovepipe, especially, you know, a brand new mission that nobody knew a whole lot about, like the aggressors. And then, you know, through time, luckily that, you know, relationship got tighter. The aggressors did kind of gain in background and credibility, and, you know, we're starting to get more integrated into those discussions. And I think ultimately that's the challenge that we have, right? We need to keep that working relationship tight so that even with the ebbs and flows that we are going to experience as a service, we can continue that crosstalk going on, because, you know, there are going to be budgetary challenges. We're going to, you know, have, you know, our personnel levels go up and down. That goes for the aggressors as well as for our counterparts at the intelligence community, at the weapons school, at test, et cetera. We have to keep this going. One, I think, important key to maybe bring into this context here as well that you didn't explicitly mention is the aggressors working relationship with the foreign material exploitation.
That was going to be my next question.
Community, yep. Within the intelligence community, right? So obviously one of the efforts that started almost at the same time that the aggressors were being built was the inception of programs like Constant Peg, right? Where clandestinely acquired threat systems, specifically, MIGs were being flown in a remote location in the desert, so that our operators could get that dissimilar experience with the real threat, with the actual real system. Of course, this was done at great expense and at great great effort there on the folks that were
spending expense, not just in money, also in
human crew and maintainers. Absolutely, yep, I mean, absolutely. What an extremely high risk mission that was, and. I think it's important to mention in this context that both of those programs, the aggressors and that those FME efforts within that context, were getting spun up almost at the same time. As a matter of fact, the aggressors were often used as a cover story to kind of keep the Constant Peg efforts under wraps there in the late 70s and the early 80s.
So I'm going to have a podcast or two at least on Constant Peg, because I love talking about it. I will just recommend right now the readers to Steve Davies' book, Red Eagles, I think is awesome. You and I both know Evil Peck, the first squadron commander of the Red Eagles, his book, America's Secret MiG Squadron, also very good. All started, you can go back to World War II, where we would capture German aircraft and then start flying them, or Japanese aircraft, and kind of that unbroken line to have drill and have donut, captured MiG-17, MiG-21. And then eventually to an industrial scale of flying a squadron's worth of MiGs, which has been declassified out of Tonopah Test Range north of Nellis. An unbelievable story, works hand in hand, and really important to talk about that same era, 70s, 80s. I think it eventually gets stood down in 86, 88, something like that. But really helps the aggressors in their ability to understand what the aircraft could do, because you're not just relying on, you know, captured documents or whatever. You either have flown the jet or flown against it or talked to somebody who's been flying it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So Constant Peg, totally, really, really important to the aggressors, an important part of aggressor history. All right. So let's move on from that. We talked a little bit about the intelligence community. You know what? I also just did recommend a couple of books. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about my favorite Air Force book, Sierra Hotel, which talks about all of this era. Anything else that I'm missing that you can think of? Any of the other books that need to be recommended?
No. And again, I think the Steve Davies and the Evil Peck books, you both already mentioned, I think those both give some fantastic background as to what was going on in and around Nellis around that time. And, you know, kind of what gave birth to the aggressors there. If some of the listeners want to maybe get a little bit more into the historical / technical side, again, there's that paper by Brian Lasley as well, right? The Air Force Way of War, U.S. Tactics and Training After Vietnam. So I think that kind of puts into context quite well that exact, you know, period of time that we were talking about in terms of, you know, the DOD taking stock of what it was doing well, what was not doing well, what was getting lost in service stovepipes, and how we then progress beyond that to a lot of these initiatives that we're touching on now.
And Dr. Lasley, a buddy of mine, he's been on the podcast as well to talk about a different book. But yeah, Air Force Way of War is excellent. Okay, so you flew with the aggressors both in the 64th and the 65th. But I think that's another kind of myth that I'd like to bust, is that the aggressors are simply red air. Certainly that's where it started. But now out at Nellis and other bases, we actually can present kind of an all domain challenge to the participants in Red Flag or Weapon School or whatever. So if you could talk about just a little bit, when we say the aggressors is more than just the 64th Aggressor Squadron, what else is associated in kind of the community of the aggressors?
For sure. So I think it became readily apparent almost from the inception of the aggressors that the threat was going to evolve. And unless the aggressors evolved with it, it was quickly going to become a, you know, non-representative mission, if you will. So we just had to continue to keep track of which way the threat was evolving and try to adapt what the aggressors were doing to counter that. One of the first efforts that came about as a result of this push was us getting a hold of some threat surface-to-air missile systems in some of the same ways we were getting those MIGs for constant peg, and actually putting those into place in the Nevada test and training range to have those be additional elements to those missions that we were flying, right? Because you would get the actual emissions coming out of those systems. You could then train to exactly what they would look like to your sensors in the jet. You could try the actual counter tactics that were proposed against those exact systems to see how well or how not so well they were working out. So that was kind of step one, right? And most of that took place in the early to mid 80s and obviously continued on throughout the history of the aggressors throughout today. Of course, now you start looking at the, you know, early to mid 2000s, and we were now looking at more of that asymmetric threat where, you know, we're not just going to be fighting this war in the air and in the surface to air domain. We have to take factors like space and cyber into account. And unless those are properly integrated, not just in our own execution on the blue side, but also on the threat replication on the red side, again, we're going to go back to that pre-Vietnam scenario. We're training to a scenario that doesn't correspond to reality, doesn't correspond to what the next fight is actually going to look like. And that is going to put us at a immediate disadvantage on day one of the war. So what was done in the mid-2000s was the creation of that whole separate group, the adversary tactics group, with subunits, the information aggressors, and the space aggressors as well, to now generate dedicated units to taking a look at what the threat was fielding in those particular domains, and then to try to integrate those into that bigger picture replication that the aggressors were providing at exercises here at Nellis and in the roadshows that we went out to teach throughout the Air Force as well.
Ooh, roadshows. That was going to be my next question, but as an intelligence professional, and I got to throw out some love in the adversary tactics group to the 547th Intelligence Squadron that has always been very, very closely linked to the aggressors, providing intelligence support to all of the aggressor squadrons, and works with the aggressor pilots and going out to the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, et cetera, some of the other intelligence agencies. All right. You mentioned roadshows. So we've talked about many of the missions that the aggressors do, like flying in Red Flag, which I'll ask you about, like supporting the weapon school. One of the ones that I love is the road shows, and that has been around really since the earliest days of the aggressors. What is a road show?
So the challenge for the aggressors has always been bandwidth, right? Every single unit in the Air Force, whether it would be a flying unit or a mission support unit of some sort, can benefit from exposure to threat data, right? I mean, we are all there to become efficient warfighters and to put, you know, doctrine into action. And how we do that 100% depends on what the threat has to say and how they're going to counter our own execution. If we stick to just the units that visit Nellis and try to give exposure to them, we're going to be shortchanging a very large chunk of the DoD that is never going to get that exposure to us. So the roadshow program was put in place specifically to counter that, where the aggressors now actually go on the road, visit other units, and try to provide some of that same training that you get here at Nellis in a smaller scale, of course, but in a deployed environment, just so we can kind of increase that repetition cycle, increase how often each unit gets that exposure to the aggressor, so their skills remain fresh, and so they get exposed to all that latest data that the aggressors have been, you know, gathering from the intelligence community and building into their simulations.
Yeah, and when the aggressors come to town, they may only bring six jets or something, but they're probably bringing their ground control intercept controllers who are simulating kind of Soviet style GCI, ground control intercept control. They're bringing the briefs to talk about the man, if you will, as well as some of the systems. So you're kind of getting more than just however many sorties you can generate out of those six jets or whatever they are. A really important way to increase the overall exposure to the aggressors, and also always a pretty good TDY.
Yeah, it goes back to the no teach replicate principle, right, Getter? I would say that looking back on my aggressor experience, some of the most worthwhile roadshow trips I ever took were trips where we didn't even bring aircraft. We literally just brought, you know, a handful of people, two, three, four, and a ton of academic briefs, and we literally just spent hours and hours in the vault over, you know, large volumes of scotch exchanging data with those guys. And that to me is the exciting part, you know, is just kind of seeing that light bulb go on over the head of an operator, because we are giving them that one piece of data that they maybe hadn't considered, or that, you know, is brand new from the IC. And that directly impacts the way they do business. And I mean, that to me is what being an aggressor is all about.
So earlier you brought up an acronym that I actually, if I knew at some point I had lost, was the It's Just Red Air, and kind of the culture of not being It's Just Red Air. I do have to bring up my favorite cultural piece. The aggressors can be very good at what they do. I mean, they fly a lot. And so you got to have kind of the right sort, not somebody that just wants to kick the blue player's ass for the sake of doing it, but actually to teach them. And it birthed my favorite saying about the aggressors that I'm probably going to have to bleep out or at least cut, which is, you know that you're cool, but not too cool. And so their phrase, and they put it on shirts, was "Be cool, you cool motherfucker," which is wonderful. I'm probably going to have to cut that, but pretty awesome. So I'm guessing that culture still exists today, that you're there not just to show how awesome you are in the airplane, but to make that other person better.
That's exactly right. And I think the aggressors have, throughout their history, had to kind of adapt their approach to the mission to achieve exactly what you're talking about. So the aggressors probably hit rock bottom in the late 80s, where the mentality started to pervade the aggressor squadrons, that it was all about getting as many kills as possible and, you know, punching your own chest and demonstrating your own superiority over how poorly Blue was doing. Clearly that wasn't working out. It was leading to unsafe scenarios. It was leading to, you know, personality conflicts where people were trying to not train realistically, but no kidding, just look good in the shower, if you will. And that led to a major attitude adjustment, right? So in the,
I mean, you had wing commanders who didn't want the aggressors coming out anymore.
100%. Yeah. And again, this defeats the purpose of aggressors existing to begin with. Right. So what was put into place as a result of that poor turn of events was a very stringent vetting process for aggressor candidates to make sure that you get guys that are not just experienced and highly credible fighter pilots, but also individuals that approach the mission with the humility and with the instructional skill required to avoid that exact scenario that you're talking about. The ability to get our hands on those highly qualified candidates obviously waxes and wanes with, you know, the personnel pressures in the Air Force, as, you know, is the case for everything else. Again, I think the ability to approach that mission with humility and then just build that skill in order to, like we were talking about earlier, get that seat at the table, get invited to those conversations, show up at other communities like TEST and like the weapons school, and be seen as somebody that can enhance the mission, vice somebody that's there to prove a point. I think that is something that takes years of honing. And I can only hope that I got even halfway to kind of that goal.
No, absolutely. And you hit on the weapons school. I think you kind of already talked about how it is that you support. And anything else that you want to add on how the aggressors help the quality or the caliber of student that is graduating from the U.S. Air Force Weapons School?
Yeah, again, great segue there, right? I think the way that I distill the mission of the aggressor is you are there as a safeguard against confirmation bias, right? If you're, you know,
I like that.
A Raptor driver or whoever you are, you if you just train within your own little bubble and you know the capabilities of your own system and you're like, oh dude, we're, you know, the best there is. And when we get to a wartime scenario, we're going to kick ass. Again, we as aggressors are there to help you validate that claim, right? That confirmation bias that got us into so much trouble back in the 70s, we want to prevent you from having that. And we want to allow you the opportunity to put some of your own assumptions about your own capabilities as a person and some of your own major design series capabilities into practice and see, you know, if no kidding, the flag goes up and now you're executing this in a real wartime scenario, what is actually the likely outcome? And that is a very, very high goal to achieve. And that's a very fine line that you have to thread in order to, you know, train realistically and, you know, set the counterparts you're working with, be they at the weapons school or at a combat air forces squadron, set them up for success.
Yeah. And I would bet, at least my perspective, and I didn't fly, I would be in the backseat for a couple of good deals, but is that a lot of the best learning doesn't necessarily occur in the air. It's really back in the vault during the debrief to talk about what you did right, but really more realistically what you did wrong. And I've always found that the aggressors are an invaluable tool in that debrief because they're going to bring the hard data. They're going to tell you what the adversary both today did and what they would do for real. So I guess, I kind of already answered my own question, but what does the debrief mean as an aggressor? How does that really enhance the learning for the folks that you work with?
It goes back to that no teach replicate principle, yeah. Right? Getter. So again, it's the knowing and the teaching. To me, looking back on my career at the aggressors, the high points that stick out to me were those missions where, you know, everything in the air worked out like it was supposed to, but those missions where we came back and we had this debrief that just exposed this awesome data set of what could have done different. And now the guys that we're flying against are having, you know, awesome conversations with each other about how to improve integration, how to tweak their TTPs to do better next time. And where the mission commanders would come up to me afterwards and would say, holy crap, dude, that was like nothing we ever seen before. That was amazing learning. And ultimately, in the debrief is where you tease out those lessons, right? You have to provide that environment for those discussions to occur, and you have to toss in those tidbits of information that you have about the threat in order to guide that discussion in the right direction. So to me, those were always the most worthwhile missions, and those were always the ones where I left feeling that sense of accomplishment at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And to get back to the point that we were talking about, it's amazing that there was a culture in the aggressors that just a couple of generations ago, we got to the point that they were nearing the end of their usefulness. And you had wing commanders who just didn't want them to be there because they weren't bringing the right tool set, the right attitude, the right culture, the right lessons. Not at all what I have seen in my career, which is that the aggressors are a critical component of what we do in the air, and then also in the debrief.
And if you think about it that way, Getter, I mean, we're almost at a similar crossroads today, right? I mean, what are the challenges we're dealing with now? The threat is fielding capabilities that we are struggling to replicate. The capabilities that we can replicate oftentimes are outgrowing the confines of the Nevada test and training range where we actually do our day-to-day business, right? We always have the fiscal challenge as well. I mean, the threat is coming up with greater and greater capabilities that we now need the resources in order to credibly simulate in our scenarios, right? We have fifth gen capabilities that are coming in. We have additional capabilities in the space and cyber realm that are becoming more and more relevant to the scenarios that we fight. So how are the aggressors going to take all these challenges and ensure that they keep that seat on the table, that they continue to be, you know, worthwhile additions to the way that we train and ultimately to the ways that we fight. So it's an ever changing a challenge. And again, being an aggressor means you have to be adaptable and you have to, again, continue to provide that exact capability that the warfighter needs to continue to perform.
And the aggressors of the 2020s are going to look a little bit different than they were of the 10s and the aughts. You mentioned fifth gen. I had General Drowley here. He didn't want to give us the exact timeline, but we're going to get some F-35 to replicate some fifth generation capabilities in the adversary world. we have all domain capabilities that are challenging the blue forces in space and cyber, using contract air, which I find fascinating, to increase the capacity so you can start to show larger presentations. But you hit on something that I think is really important. We still just have as great as the Nevada Test and Training Range is. It's a national asset. It's huge, but it's not huge on the scale of 2020 and 2030 fighting. So I guess, you know, I kind of answered a little bit of my own question of where the aggressors are going. But a question that I did have for you is, are the aggressors kind of getting into the live virtual constructed game, or LVC, in that you'll get in the simulators and test the friendlies that way? Is there some of that starting to go on, or had already started while you were flying the aggressors?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, the aggressors have to be a part of that solution. They've been integrally participating in the spin up of the VTTC, which again is that.
And what is that?
Kind of center, the virtual test and training center, which is essentially going to be that nerve center at Nellis that integrates those live virtual constructive elements into one coherent scenario that makes sense and that actually replicates what a threat scenario would look like credibly. And again, what better party to roll into the problem to make sure that it's properly simulated and it's as high fidelity as possible than the aggressors? That's literally their bread and butter. It's what they do. I was happy to see, as my career was winding down at Nellis, that is one element that they were very integral participants in. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. And just if you check out the news and you see just what China is doing near the Taiwanese and sometimes inside the Taiwanese aid is their defense identification zone. They're sending 20, 30, 40 airplanes at a time. That is tough to replicate on the Nevada Test and Training Range. And that's just the low end. If we were ever, and none of us hope for this, but if we're ever to fight across the Taiwan Strait, they're going to be sending up dozens and dozens of guerrilla formations, so to speak. And you just don't have the capacity to do that in the real world. We don't have enough aggressor jets to do that. We're always, there's a huge role to play in the air, but there's always going to be some, more reliance on our virtual ways of doing this, of doing business.
I 100% agree. And I think one of my all-time favorite stories that just kind of gives you an idea of how important a concept the aggressors are and how little parallels there are for the aggressors in any kind of foreign military service. Back in, I believe this was 2012. Don't ask me how that came about. I don't know what he was actually here for, but the chief of staff of the Russian Federation Air Force actually did a quick touch and go at Nellis. This was Colonel General Zelen. I don't remember what his first name was. But he was here, and as you can imagine, that was a big flipping event. I mean, they obviously very high level DOD VIPs were involved, and they had a very, you know, carefully crafted schedule as to what they wanted to show him at Nellis. Obviously, within the constraints of what you would show the chief of staff of the Russian Air Force, right? In the center of excellence for everything we do as a fighting force here at Nellis. So, you know, they were, you know, showing him the range building and the flat line and, you know, all the other things at Nellis that are, you know, the showpieces here. And he actually, about a third of the way through the tour, stopped everything and said, "This is all very interesting, but I would really like to see the aggressors." So, I mean, you know,
that's awesome.
If the Russian chief of staff, if that's no kidding, his number one interest coming into Nellis, I mean, that's definitely if that doesn't tell you we're doing business right, then I don't know what does. And I know that there's been efforts from multiple other threat countries to see how we do business as aggressors, see how we come up with these simulation models and these scenarios that we use here to try to do it exactly the same way back in their home countries. And I know that that capability has not been duplicated anywhere else.
All right. Last major question about aggressor missions is red flag. So we've already talked about, and I'm going to talk more about red flag as what I believe, and it's not just me, but it is that believe this, it's the world's greatest air and space and now airspace and cyber exercise in terms of realism and training for U.S. friends. It is an amazing exercise that is covers a lot. The aggressors play a critical role. My first question for you, just real quickly, how many red flags do you think you've been a part of? Could you even guess?
I do, because actually right before I flew, my last red flag was, which was 21-3. It just concluded a few months ago. Yep. I made the effort of going back and counting how many flags I did altogether. And as luck would have it, 21-3 was a nice round number. It was my 40th. Wow. So, if there's somebody out there that's done more flags, I don't know who that is. So, but yeah, that it was a, it's a great, great experience to look back on. And it's always been the pinnacle of what we do as aggressors.
Absolutely. But my question to red flag or on this subject is, what does an aggressor, maybe a MiG one or whatever, how does the aggressor, or the aggressors as a whole, develop kind of the presentation that they are going to give to the friendlies? How do they ensure that red flag meets its stated mission from the very start of giving Blue 4 those 10 combat missions to ensure that he or she is ready to survive when they're doing it for real? What's the role of the aggressors in red flag?
That question alone, Getter, is probably something we could talk for yep. multiple hours on, as you can imagine. So it's a beast of a subject area to tackle. I will say it this way. Red flag, just like everything else in the DoD, has had its ebbs and flows as well, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think the tendency that we've seen over the years is anytime the exercise is approached with too much of a focus on who is winning and who is losing, that is where we have a tendency to lose training, right? Everybody, both the Blue Air and the aggressors, should always approach that exercise from a standpoint of, we don't care who's winning, how good of a learning are we getting out of this? And how well are we preparing the warfighter for that, you know, that wartime scenario that he needs to be ready for? I can tell you that even that goal of, you know, kind of providing that first 10 combat missions that, you know, Moody Suter brought into life and advocated very strongly for, even that baseline goal has kind of come and gone over the years. There have been red flag commanders that said, we don't want to do that anymore.
Exactly. General Jolly mentioned that and said they're bringing it back, right? Because so everybody was throwing their own stuff on there to different learning objectives. But General Jolly, I thought, was pretty clear in saying we're getting back to Blue 4's first 10 missions.
Absolutely.
And Blue 4 is very broadly defined, not just Blue 4 being the number 4 wingman in a 4-ship formation. That Blue 4 could be an intelligence professional. It could be an air battle manager. There's a lot of people who are getting great training. Absolutely. Blue 4 is a euphemism, if you will. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt again.
No, that's a great point to make there. And again, the additional point to make there is red flag only remains at the high quality that it is if you try to make it very good training for a select group of warfighters, right? If you try to build in everybody into one red flag, we now get into these scenarios where, you know, we've gotten negative feedback from the warfighter before, which is, you know, we're spending 90% of our time trying not to hit each other and 10% of our time practicing any tactics, which is no good either, right? So you have to draw that very fine line. How many people do we allow to take part in the exercise so the training can still be good while still bringing on enough participants within the capacity constraints of the Nevada test and training range to where that training is still high quality and the threat, you know, simulation that we can execute against the Blue Force is still high fidelity enough. So cracking that nut, to answer your question in a very roundabout way, cracking that nut, I think, is what the key role of the aggressors is to provide that expertise and to advise the 414th Combat Training Squadron staff on how to best shape their scenarios, how to best shape the number of participants in individual missions in order to preserve that stated goal of the exercise, which is, again, to provide as close as possible to a simulation of those 10 first combat missions to just increase everybody's survivability should we get into a real conflict scenario.
So as we wind this down, I'm going to transition from a very important, weighty question, how you make red flag valuable, to a silly question, but I love to talk about, especially around the bar, what's your favorite aggressor color for the Jets? Which one, what's the livery that you'd most like to see on a jet that you're walking out to?
I'm going to give a little bit of a multifaceted answer here on this one. So I don't know if you've seen the Wraith paint scheme that the Aggressors have been flying with since relatively recently.
Is that the new black one with the red star?
All black with all black. Red highlights, if you will.
Red highlight, yeah.
Depth Jet is absolutely incredible looking. Our maintainers actually went to the extent of taking off the gray radome in front of that Viper and somehow sourcing a black one somewhere. The radome can't be painted, right, because the radars are behind it. Somehow they managed to get their hands on one that was made out of black composite. I have no clue how they did it, but that jet looks absolutely amazing. It just has one distinct drawback, which is in the 110 degree heat of the Nellis summer, it becomes an absolute oven. That jet is miserable to fly in the summer. So I think ultimately my favorite paint scheme, the one that I'll have to go back on, is the Splinter scheme that was brought online with the 65th Eagles. As a matter of fact, 494, the Eagle that had my name on it, had that exact paint scheme when they first brought it online. I was super happy to see that that Splinter scheme, which is very similar, as you know, to the real life Su-57 paint scheme, that thing got preserved and is now flying in some of the 64th Aggressor Vipers as well. So a great looking jet, and I'll forever have some nostalgia for those 65th Eagles. They just looked amazing.
Oh, they did, and it's a fun thing to talk about. The bar you have over your shoulder, the original blue scheme, the first Eagle, as I recall, that came out left the Aggressors, it was 0058. It was a D model. And it had my name on it when it went out there. It was one of the two seaters, and as the intelligence officer, I got to have it on there. There's a splinter
right.
Oh
here,
so. Yeah, there we go. That is sweet. Just awesome. I might have to take a screenshot of that. All right, I've already taken more of your time than I intended to, in part because I didn't hit record the first time we did this, and we still got football today. Anything else that you want to cover on the Aggressors? There's so much we could talk about. Anything that you feel that maybe we've missed?
I think maybe the parting shot is something that we kind of already touched on, right? Which is every mission in the Air Force is only going to be as good as how much, you know, firepower you put behind it. The Aggressors have always fought from a position of disadvantage because we don't have a, you know, mission area manager or a SME sitting at the staff fighting on our behalf. We don't have anybody in terms of, you know, a GO whose pet program we are that, you know, mentions our capabilities and what we need from a resource standpoint when, you know, those fights are taking place. So spare a thought for the Aggressors that are trying to do this, you know, key mission, which I find critical for the continued effectiveness of our warfighter. Again, but with one hand tied behind their back. So again, for the listeners that are still in the service and are in
any Pentagon programmers, find your cuts elsewhere.
Please write Aggressor on your sticky note, and any chance you have to mention us within the context of high level decision making being made in the Air Force. Those guys need all the help they can get, and they have such a critical mission that I think is vital to our continued viability as a service.
What a great point. Don't bring directly combat capability to bear, and so they seem easy on the chopping block. You know, keep the operational squadrons. But boy, if we didn't have the Aggressor mission, and not just the flying Aggressors, the entire thing, including the intelligence apparatus that supports it, you would not have the quality of blue forces that you have, not just in the U.S., but also in allied and partner air forces and really militaries writ large. Just a wonderful mission. And Cuts, I think you've done an awesome job of being a passionate advocate for the Aggressors. It was a great conversation. Glad I was able to get in the paint scheme question. That is my silly one. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm glad we were able to make it work.
You tied it together extremely well. I couldn't have said it any better than how you kind of put the bow around it there at the end. And I greatly appreciate the invite, Getter. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, that does it for another episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation on knowing, teaching, and replicating the story of the Air Force Aggressors with Lieutenant Colonel retired Jan Cuts Stahl. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are mine alone and do not reflect the official policy or position of the United States government, the Department of Defense, or the United States Air Force.
As always, feel free to engage with me on social media. I'm at AirMindedPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Keep the feedback coming. This week, I ran a poll on your favorite aggressor paint scheme that seemed to get a lot of you going, and we had some good conversations. So keep that coming. Thanks for tuning into the Air Minded Podcast. I'm your host, the Air Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off until next time. Thanks.